Darkwind replied grimly, thinking of all Nyara had told him. Starblade nodded. The only way I could think of to protect you was to drive you away from me, so that the more I tried, beneath his compulsion, to bring you back to magic, the more you would fight it. Then, when my mind was not my own, you were safe. He looked up tearfully, entreatingly at his son. Can you ever forgive me? Darkwind blinked away tears. Of course I can forgive you, he said quickly, and took a deep breath to calm himself. He looked up at Ice Shadow. How clear is he? He asked. Ice Shadow shook his head. I've only begun, the adept replied, exhaustion blurring his words a little. It's going to be a long process. The bastards set the compulsions in a few days, but they've had all this time to work and develop. We'll have to keep him under shield the whole time. Put him in the work area, Darkwind suggested. It has strong shields, and there aren't any apprentices who need it right now. Those shields are the best we have. Which is why I was not permitted to go there, Starblade whispered. The bird would not let me. Then that is a good indicator that the shields will hold, don't you think? Darkwind responded. He started to let go of Starblade's hand, but his father clutched it despite the pain that must have caused. Wait! He coughed. Dawnfire! Darkwind froze. Ice Shadow asked the question he could not manage to get out. What about Dawnfire? The adept asked. She's dead. No, Starblade said urgently. The bird was never found, but his sign was on her body. I think he has her, trapped in her bird. Still alive, but helpless. Another toy. Starblade's face was twisted, but this time with what he remembered. It would please him very much. Chapter 21 Elspeth. The sky burned blue, but eight hooves pounded their own frantic thunder on the earth of the plains. Grass stems lashed their legs and the barrels of the companions as they fled. Elspeth risked a look back, her hair whipping into her face and making her eyes water. The pack of fluid brown shapes streaming through the grasses behind them seemed a little closer. It was hard to tell for certain. They were visible only as a flowing darkness in the grasses, and the movement of the vegetation as they disturbed it. Then the lead beast leapt up, showing its head, and she was sure of it. They're gaining on us, she shouted at Skiff. He looked back, then bent farther down over Simri's neck like a jockey. She did the same, trying to cut her wind resistance. The companions were running as fast as they could, which was very fast indeed. The ground flowed beneath their hooves at such a rate that after one look that made her dizzy, she kept her eyes fixed ahead. She could not imagine how any creature could be capable of keeping up with them. It seemed impossible that they could be moving this fast. "What are these things?" she asked Gwena, who flattened her ears a little more and rolled her eyes back at her rider. "I don't know," the companion replied, bewildered. "I've never heard of anything like them." Sweat streamed down her outstretched neck, and the ends of her mane lashed Elspeth's face and got into her mouth.
I have, the sword cut in gruffly. Damn things are magical constructs, beasts put together by an adept. Probably all they're good for is running.
Elspeth looked back again, nervously. The pack leader gave another of those jumps. That took it briefly above the level of the grass stalks, this time showing its head clearly. Its mouth was open, its tongue out like a dog's. All she really saw were the jaws, a mouthful of thumb-length fangs.
Well, running and killing, Need amended. Whatever, they're not of a type I've seen before. That makes them twice as dangerous. I can't tell you what they're capable of.
Thanks, Elspeth muttered under her breath. She peered ahead, wishing there was any way she could use her distance viewer. Somewhere on the cliff ahead of them, hopefully somewhere near, was a path like the one they had descended. This trail was next to a waterfall, and she strained her eyes for a glimpse of water streaming down the side of the cliff into the plains. If they could reach that path, they could probably hold the things off,
They might be able to climb it faster than the beasts could. Certainly they would be able to hold the narrow trail against their pursuers if they turned to stand at bay. At the top of that path lay the place circled on the map. Whether or not there was any help for them there, the companions were getting tired. How long could they keep this pace up? Her nose caught the scent of water as they topped a rise, just as she saw the line of green, a line of verdant trees and bushes, at the edge of a long slope, down below them. There was a glint of reflected light from the cliff. She assumed that was the promised waterfall. She closed her eyes for a moment and set loose her farsight, looking for a place to make a stand. There wasn't much else she could do at the moment, other than make certain she was in no danger of being tossed off if Gwena had to make a sudden move. Nothing at the bottom of the cliff. No, that was definitely no place to make a stand. The waterfall splashed down onto rocks right beside the beginning of the trail. The rocks were wet and slippery, marginal for booted feet, treacherous for hooves. In fact, the entire path was like that, winding beneath the waterfall at times, skirting the edge of it at others. This was not a straight fall. The water dropped through a series of basins and down many tumbles of rocks, keeping spray to a minimum. It might almost have been sculpted that way, and the path appeared to be an afterthought, cut into the stone around the fall as best as could be. The path was narrow, too narrow to allow more than one rider at a time. She scanned the entire length of it and found no place wide enough for the four of them to hold off their followers. If they made a stand, it would have to be at the top. So she turned her far sight to the top, and there at last was the shelter she had been searching for. There were ruins up there, tumbles of massive rocks, identifiable only as ruins because of the regular size and shape of the stones, and the general shapes of what might once have been walls. Right where the path reached the top, there was a good place to hole up.
"There's magic there," Need said suddenly, looking through Elspeth's eyes. "Do you see that kind of shimmer? That's magic energy. With luck, I can use it to help with defense."
"I don't intend to get close enough to those things to have to use a blade," Elspeth retorted.
"Duns, I didn't mean for you to fight. I mean to channel my magic through you. I was a fairly good mage. You may even learn something."
Elspeth felt stunned. "I thought you only protected."
"That was when I was asleep," the sword said shortly. "Why don't you see what you can do about picking off some of those beasts? Maybe if you kill one, the others will stop to eat it."
Well, it was worth trying. The long slope gave the companions some relief. Though tiring, they were running with a bit less strain. Gwena's coat was still sweat-foamed, but her breathing beneath Elspeth's legs was easier. Elspeth pulled her bow from the saddle sheath, freed an arrow from the quiver at her knee. She clamped her legs tight around Gwena's barrel and turned, sitting up a little higher in her saddle as she did so. The leader of the pack had a peculiar bounding rhythm to his chase. It was, she discovered, rather like sighting on a leaping hare. And she had done that so many times she had lost count. Hunting had been one of the few ways she could escape the palace and her rank and position. "Although I wish I had a hawk right now to set on them. A big hawk, with long, long talons." The leader's bound carried him below the grass. She knocked and loosed, and he leapt right into the arrow's path. Soundless they were on the chase. Soundlessly he fell, and he fell right under the feet of his pack. Whether or not they would, as Need had so gruesomely suggested, stop to eat him, it didn't matter. At least not at the moment, not while at least half the pack tumbled over the body of the leader, and the rest stopped their headlong chase to mill aimlessly around the dead and the fallen. She knocked and loosed another arrow, and a third, both finding targets, before Gwena carried her out of range. Never once did any of those she hit utter a single sound.
"Good work," the companion said without slowing. "That should buy us some time." "Assuming something else doesn't take their place, or join them," the sword pointed out grimly. "I hate to say this, but I do sense things stirring, energies being disturbed, and some kind of communication going on that I can't read. I'm afraid we're going to have something else on our trail before long." She didn't say what she was thinking. It wasn't as if Need had willfully called these things up.
Will we have a chance to get up on that path first?
I think we'll make it up to the top. But there's more trouble up there. It's at the border of a bad area, and it has its own energies that are reacting to the changes elsewhere. I think you should know that disturbance brings predators and scavengers alike.
Well, that was no more than the law of nature.
She sheathed the bow again and looked back down their trail. There was nothing immediately in sight. But there was a dark golden cloth of something on the horizon, something tall enough to be visible above the grass, and it was coming closer. She rather doubted it was a herd of Shinnein goats.
The scent of water was stronger. She turned to face forward. The belt of greenery was near enough now to make out individual trees and bushes, and the waterfall dashed down the side of the cliff with a careless gaiety she wished she shared. She knew what awaited them, and held Gwena back a little to let Skiff shoot ahead of her.
Simri's headlong pace slowed as she met the slippery rocks of the trail.
Gwena's shoulders bunched beneath Elspeth's knees as she prepared to make the climb.
The scramble up the trail was purest nightmare. If it had not been that the companions were far more sure-footed than the heralds were, and far, far faster, even on footing this treacherous, she would have stopped to dismount. As it was, she clung to the saddle with legs and both hands, drenched with water spray and her own sweat of fear. If she dared, she would have closed her eyes.
Gwena skidded and slipped on the spray-slick rocks. She went to her knees at last, once for every switchback, and there seemed to be hundreds of those. Every time Gwena lurched sideways, Elspeth lurched with her, further unbalancing the companion and hindering her recovery. The only good thing was that the slower pace enabled Gwena to catch her breath again.
Ahead, Simri and Skiff were in no better shape.
That presented a second danger, that they might lose their balance and careen into Gwena and Elspeth, sending all four of them to their deaths. Gwena might have read her mind. The companion stopped for a moment, sides heaving, to let Simri put a little more distance between them. She stood with her head hanging, breathing deeply, extracting everything she could from the brief rest. Elspeth used the respite to peer through the spray, down to the foot of the trail. The entire trail was visible from this vantage point, and there was nothing on it except them. Yet, but peering up at her, at least she presumed they were peering up at her, were several creatures of a dark gold color that would have blended imperceptibly into the grasslands. They stood out now only because of the brilliant green of the vegetation below the waterfall. Milling around them were some dark brown, slender beasts, whose fluid movements told her that the pack that had pursued them had recovered from the loss of its leader. In fact, there seemed to be more of them.
I think I know what that blot on the horizon was now. I wonder where the other hounds came from, though.
And mingling with those creatures was something else. Black, small animals that hopped rather than walked. She guessed from their behavior that there was some kind of consultation going on. The black creatures seemed to be the ones in charge, or conveying some kind of orders. As she watched, the thin creatures arrayed themselves below the cliff, providing a kind of rear guard. The golden brown forms lined up in an orderly fashion and started up the path with a sinister purposefulness. And the black dots sprouted wings, and rose into the air.
Crows, she realized. Then, as they drew nearer, dearest gods, they're so big!
They were heading straight for the heralds, and they could do a great deal of damage with those long, sharp bills, those fierce claws. Without being prompted by the sword, she pulled her bow again, hoping that dampness hadn't gotten to the string. She knocked and sighted, and released, and repeated the action, filling the air below her with half a dozen arrows. Only three reached their mark, and one of those was by accident, as a crow flew into the path of one of the arrows while trying to avoid another. Of those three, one was only a wound. It passed through the nearest crow's wing, and the bird spiraled down to the earth, cawing its pain and keeping itself aloft with frantic flaps of its good wing. Poor as the marksmanship had been, it was enough to deter the rest of the birds. They kited off sideways, out of her arrow range,
caught a thermal, and rode through the air as fast as their wings could flap to vanish over the top of the cliff. Gwena lurched back into motion, and Elspeth was forced to put her bow away and resume her two-handed clutch on the saddle pommel. They were barely a third of the way to the top of the cliff and the shelter of the ruins. She hoped they would see that shelter, and that what awaited them at the top was not a further nest of foes. Wherever the crows had gone, they had not managed to herd another clutch of magically constructed creatures to the ruins to meet them, and they didn't return to harass the heralds themselves. Elspeth heaved a sigh of relief that was echoed by Gwena as they approached the edge of the cliff without seeing any further opposition to their progress. They reached the end of the path without meeting any other dangers than the treacherous path itself, though the last third, so high above the floor of the plains, had put Elspeth's heart in her throat for the entire journey. She tried to use her far sight to spy out the land ahead, but either her fear or something outside of herself interfered with her ability to see. She thought the way was clear, but she drew her bow again, just in case it wasn't. They scrambled up the final switchback, with Elspeth praying that there wasn't anything lying in ambush, and found themselves on a smooth apron of masonry, uneven and weathered, with weeds growing through the cracks. But there was no time to marvel. A new threat climbed the trail behind them, a threat that was sure-footed enough to have closed the gap between them. Elspeth had not had any chance to shoot at these new followers, but they were much bigger than the first creatures that had pursued them across the plain, as well as being armored with horny plates, and she was not terribly confident that their arrows would make much of an impression on these beasts, and they were barely two switchbacks behind the heralds. She and Gwena pushed past Skiff and scrambled for the shelter of that ruined tower-like edifice she had seen. He followed right on Gwena's crupper. The companion's hooves rang on the stone in perfect rhythm, sounding like one single horse. They reached the shelter of the stones just barely ahead of their pursuers. The first of the creatures came over the edge of the cliff as they whisked into a narrow cleft between two standing walls, a cleft just wide enough for the two of them, or one of them and the companion, but deep enough for several to work unhindered behind whoever held the front. Skiff and Simri reached the cleft last, which put them in the position of initial defenders. As Elspeth threw herself from the saddle, she reached for bowcase and quiver. As she fumbled with the straps that held both in place on the saddle skirt, the sword at her side uncoiled its power and struck. At her! Her hand closed on the hilt of the blade before she was quite aware of what was happening. But as need moved to take over the rest of her body, she fought back. It was a brief, sharp struggle. It ended in the blade's surprised capitulation.
"What in hell is wrong with you, girl?" Need shrilled in her mental ear. "I thought you were going to let me work magic against those things."
"Through me, not using me," she snarled back. "That's my body you're trying to take over. You didn't ask. You just tried to take." Need seemed very much taken aback. While the blade pondered, Elspeth retrieved her bow and quiver and counted out her shots. There were depressingly few arrows left. What she had, she would have to use carefully.
"You've got a mothering strong mage gift," the blade said,
as Elspeth positioned herself behind Skiff, with one arrow knocked to her bowstring.
"I think if I guide you through it, we ought to be able to fend these things off long enough to give us a breathing space. Relax a little, will you?"
Elspeth let down her guard, reluctantly.
"That's all I need," Need said. "This will be like learning how to shoot. My hand's on yours, guiding, that's all. Now look, with your far sight, below us."
Elspeth obeyed, wondering if this was a waste of time. But to her amazement, there was something down there, a kind of web of light with a bright glow where the lines all met.
"Those are ley lines. The thing in the middle is a node. Reach out and touch it. I'll help you."
There was an odd sensation that was similar to that of having hands on hers. She followed the guidance of those invisible hands, reaching out to touch, just barely touch, that bright glow. Although her physical hands merely pointed off into the heart of the ruins, those other hands penetrated deeply beneath the ground, deeper, she sensed, than the plains below them. It was not effortless. She was sweating and trembling by the time she made contact, weak-kneed with the effort, as if she had run up a second cliff trail as long as the one they had just traversed. Then she touched this node, and was hit with a blast of power, as if she stood in the path of an onrushing torrent. If she could have cried out, she would have. She had never felt so entirely helpless in her life.
Damn it!
Those invisible hands caught her, steadied her. She saw how they were holding her against the power, and altered her stance, opening to it instead of resisting it. Opening what, she didn't know. In point of fact, it felt like opening a door that she hadn't been aware existed. Now, instead of being swept away by the flood of power, she had become a conduit for it. It filled her, rather than overwhelming her.
Good, the sword said with grudging admiration. I wasn't that quick, even when I was your age, and I never could handle nodes, only local energy, shallow lines, and power pools. I think I'm jealous.
Elspeth opened her eyes to discover that the creatures that had followed them were only now lining up in front of their shelter. Amazingly, hardly any time at all had passed.
Well, child, Need said with grim satisfaction, let's show these beasts that the mice they thought they'd trapped have fangs.
Elspeth followed the blade's direction, raising her hands above her head and clasping them together for a moment while the power built within her, flooding channels she discovered as they were being filled, then letting it loose with a gesture of throwing.
You won't need to do that forever, Need
told her, as a lance of energy, like a lightning bolt, leapt from her hand to impact squarely in the chest of one of the creatures. Eventually, you'll be able to send power without making those stupid gestures, and you'll be able to use it less crudely. But this will do for now.
Even as the blade spoke, she guided Elspeth through another three such displays. Skiff and the companions had been taken entirely by surprise. They stood looking at Elspeth as if she had suddenly grown an extra head, staring, despite the danger outside the cleft, as if they did not recognize her. For that matter, she wasn't entirely sure she recognized herself. Here she was, flinging lightning bolts about as if they were children's balls. Elspeth, protected heir, who had never been outside of Valdemar. Elspeth, otherwise very ordinary herald, who had never been thought to have a particularly strong gift, much less something like this. The power sang through her mind, light coalescing at her fingers and striking out in showers of sparks. Unfortunately, when the dazzle cleared from her eyes, it was apparent that her fiery attacks had not impressed the hunters that much.
Damn, the sword swore. They've been given some protection against magic attack. I didn't know that could be done with constructs.
And, as if to herself, I wonder what else has changed. As the exhilaration of power and the impetus of fear both faded, Elspeth leaned against the rock wall and blinked to clear her eyes. For the first time, Elspeth got a good look at their foes, as they huddled at a respectful distance from the opening of the cleft, their heads together as if they were discussing something. Perhaps they were. They were shaped rather like cattle, with horny plates instead of hair, and all of that uniform golden brown that resembled the color of the parched grasslands of the plains. They were not as clumsy, however, and were as tall at the shoulder as any of the Ashkevron warhorses. Nor were their heads or legs at all bovine. They bore resemblance to no animal that Elspeth recognized. From sharp, back-swept horns, to wide-slitted eyes, to fanged mouths, their heads were alien and as purposeful as the pack of beasts that had chased the heralds across the plains. And there were odd feet on those legs, a kind of claw hoof, the front legs more like a dog's than a cow's. The consultation ended, and half of the beasts trotted out of sight. Elspeth had no fear that they would come in from behind. Those hooves were never made for climbing rock, and the tumble of stones behind them was beyond the capability of anything lacking human-like hands and feet. What they were undoubtedly doing was making sure that the heralds did not escape by climbing the rocks and slipping away. The remainder of the creatures settled down, as if perfectly prepared for a long wait.
"I hate to tell you this," Mead said gloomily, "but if these things have defenses to magical attacks, they have probably been constructed very well. They might not need to eat, drink, or even sleep."
She sighed and pulled her damp hair behind her ears.
"Well, that was just what I needed to hear," she muttered.
"What was?" Skiff asked, and she realized that the blade had left him out of the conversation again, probably deliberately. Elspeth explained, as she and Simri traded places.
"Oh, hell," he groaned. "We're safe for now, I guess, but how are we going to get out of here? Poison the damn things?"
"They have to have a weakness somewhere," she replied absently, studying the beasts with narrowed eyes. "If they're protected in one area, that probably means they've given up protection somewhere else." Suddenly, one of the beasts, which had been utterly silent up until then, let out a blood-curdling shriek. End of Side 9. Side 10. Winds of Fate by Mercedes Lackey. Continuing on page 377. The one nearest the opening reared up to its full height, pawing at something in its throat, its head and neck extended as far as they could reach while it shrieked again. As it reared, they saw what had hit it. An arrow, buried to the fletchlings in its throat. The underbody was covered with soft skin, unlike the horny hide plates. The area of weakness Elspeth had been hoping for. Her heart surged with elation, and her energy returned redoubled. A second arrow whirred past and thudded into the creature's chest as it teetered on its hind legs. It bellowed again, then collapsed and did not move. While its fellows began to look about confusedly, Skiff darted out of cover before Elspeth could stop him. As a third arrow skimmed past him, just beyond his shoulder, and bounced off the hide of the nearest beast, distracting it, he flung one of his throwing knives at the beast's eye. It hit squarely. The tiny knives were razor-sharp and heavy for their tiny size. The second beast threw up its head and collapsed like its brother. Skiff darted back into cover. Before he had done more than reach the shelter of the cleft, a huge shadow passed overhead. They both looked up as a second shadow followed the first, and a cry, like that of an eagle, but 100 times louder, rang out.
"Dear God!"
Elspeth gasped, and for one moment she could not even think.
"What the hell are those?"
the sword asked. Elspeth shook with nerves and fear as the huge griffins stooped on their pursuers. She had known, intellectually, that griffins existed. Heralds had seen them in the sky north of Valdemar, but no one she knew had ever seen one this close. Or at least, if they had, they'd not lived to report the fact. For one panicked moment, she thought they had come to join the other beasts against them, and these creatures would not have the limitations of the hooved ones in prying the heralds out of their shelter. But they attacked the strange creatures with talons and beaks, knocking one of them entirely off the cliff and killing another before Elspeth could react, shrieking defiance as they shredded flesh and flew off again. Well, whatever they are, even if they aren't on our side, they aren't on their side either. The rest of the beasts turned to defend themselves, forming a heads-out circle, and it was clear that there would be no more easy kills. It was also clear that the griffins were not going to give up, nor, from the carefully placed arrows, was their still unseen ally. And damn if I'm going to let them do this alone. Maybe they've heard the old saying about how, "The enemy of my enemy is my friend." She ran out, knocking another arrow to her bow, before Skiff could grab her and haul her back to safety. "Come on!" she shouted back at him, allowing a hint of mockery to enter her voice. "What are you waiting for? Winter?" Elspeth rested her back against a rock and slid down it. Skiff slumped nearby, with his head hanging, his forearms propped on his bent knees, and his hands dangling limply. There was a long, shallow gash in her leg that she didn't remember getting, and another wound, a bite, on her arm that she only recalled vaguely. It was a good thing she had more clothing with her. All white, though. The merc outfits were filthy. She'd taken both hits after she'd run out of arrows and knives, and the damned sword had insisted on getting in close to fight hand to... tooth. Horn. Whatever. Neither wound was bleeding, and neither one hurt.
I told you, that's my doing.
That was Need, still unsheathed and in her hand. It was covered in dark, sticky blood, and she had not yet regained the energy to clean it. She had the feeling that the sword wouldn't care, but if she ever put any blade in its sheath without cleaning it, she knew in her soul that Caro and Albrecht would walk on air to beat her black and blue. The smug satisfaction in the sword's tone would have been annoying if she hadn't been so tired.
I let him bleed enough to clean him out. Then I took care of him.
Well, you were the one that was responsible for my getting hurt in the first place, she retorted, watching the gash and bite mark heal before her eyes. I should think you'd take care of them. The sword muttered something about ingratitude. Elspeth ignored it. The griffins, and presumably the archer, had gone in pursuit of the enemy creatures once their combined attack had broken the beast's circle and forced them into flight. Neither the heralds nor their companions had been in any shape to join the chase. Grena plodded over to Elspeth's side and nosed her arm. At least that piece of tin is useful as a healer, the companion observed. Are we going to find somewhere safe to rest, do you think? Some place secure? I'd really like to go to sleep for a week or so.
Unless those griffins saved us just to eat us themselves. I think we are, Elspeth responded, unable to muster much concern over the prospect of becoming griffin fodder.
She had just learned the truth of something Quentin had warned her about. It took energy to use energy, and hers was spent and overspent. Right now, she was just about ready to pass out, safe or not. But the sound of a falcon's cry made her look up. There was an enormous raptor skimming along, barely clearing the tops of the stones, winging his way out of the forest. An omen?
That would be all they needed now. Something more to wonder about.
For a moment, she thought it was her weary, blurring eyes that made the vegetation behind him seem to move, as if part of the forest had separated and was walking toward her. But then... the vegetation stepped a little farther out into the open and became a man. Her hiss of warning brought Skiff's head up, and they both struggled to their feet to meet the stranger standing, their companions moving a little into the shadows out of immediate sight as they rose. She stood so that Need was not so obviously still in her hand.
No point in looking belligerent.
He was a somber-looking young man, tall, taller than Skiff. And slender, and handsome, strikingly handsome, with a sculptured face and tough, graceful body. He'd already slung his bow across his back, a long bow, much more finely crafted than anything Elspeth had ever seen in use before. His green, gray, and brown clothing blended so well with the forest that he faded into the background every time he paused. His long hair was an odd, mottled brown that helped with the camouflage effect considerably. As he neared, Elspeth saw that he had the same piercing, ice-blue eyes and bone structure of the Shinnain she had seen, though his complexion was a paler gold than theirs. As the man drew nearer, the falcon wheeled and returned. Without looking, the stranger held out his gauntleted wrist, and the falcon, much larger, she realized, than any bird she had ever seen, other than, say, an eagle, dropped down gracefully to his fist, and settled itself with a flip of its wings. That was when she finally made the connection. Dear God, he must be one of the Hawk Brothers. She felt as if she really had stepped into the pages of a legend. First, she was visited by a Shinnain Kalenadral, then chased by monsters, then rescued by griffins. And now, here was a Hawk Brother, a creature out of legend so remote that she had only found references to them in Vanyol's chronicles. Moondance and Starwind, Vanyol's friends, mages, adepts, in fact, from the clan of Katreva. The man paused at a polite distance from the heralds and frowned as if he wasn't certain how to address them or which of them to speak to first. She wondered if she should solve his quandary. But before she could speak, he made up his mind. "Who are you?" he demanded arrogantly in trade tongue. "What are you doing in Taladrath land? Why are you here?"
"And who are you to ask? I didn't see any boundary markers."
She drew herself up, answering his arrogance with pride of her own. "Harold Elspeth and Harold Skiff, out of Valdemar, and we were chased here by monsters, as you likely noticed," she replied stiffly in the same language. "We didn't exactly plan on it, and we didn't stop to ask directions. Any more questions?" To her surprise, he actually started to smile, at least a little. But that was when Gwena poked her nose from behind her chosen and looked at him with a combination of inquiry and tentative approval. His eyes widened, and to Elspeth's amazement, he paled. She took an involuntary step backward, and that brought Need into view. He glanced down, took a second, very surprised look, and went a little whiter. He mumbled something under his breath that sounded like Shinnein, but was different enough that she couldn't make out what he was saying. It seemed to have something to do with bodily functions. Well, as long as he'd seen the damned sword, and hadn't interpreted it as hostility, she might as well put it away properly. She turned a little, fished a cleaning rag out of Gwena's saddlebag as he watched her warily, and began wiping the blade clean. It practically cleaned itself. Then again, maybe that wasn't surprising, all things considered. The Hawk Brother mumbled something again, and she looked up as she sheathed her sword properly and wiped off her filthy hand. "What did you say?" she asked politely, but with a touch of the same arrogance he had been showing them. He shook his head, but he did seem to be unbending just a little. "Never mind," he said. "It matters not. It would seem that I am to add you to the colony of outlanders I am collecting." "And what if we don't want to go?" she retorted, taken aback by his assumption that she would obey him without a second thought. "There are four of us and only one of you." "This is our land you trespass on. There are four of us," he corrected mildly, as the griffin swooped in from behind her to land at his side. The wind created by their wings as they landed, making a tiny tempest that blew dust into her face and made her squint. "And I think two of us are bigger than all of you." She tightened her jaw, refusing to be intimidated. "Is that a threat?" she snapped. "I think we might surprise you if it is." He sighed. "No, it is not a threat. If you wish to descend to the plains, you are free to do so. But I must tell you, there are four of us that stand guard here. I will not permit you to pass through Taladrath lands, and your escort still awaits you below the cliff. Our Shinnein brethren have not chosen to disperse them, and we above do not trespass upon the plains without invitation." "Oh," she said, deflated. "What do you know about these people?" she asked the sword.
"Not a damn thing," Need replied. "Never heard of them, and I don't recognize the language. They're either something I never ran into, or they sprang up after my time."
The young man cleared his throat, delicately, recalling her attention. "I feel as if I must point out that you would not be safe from anything with that at your side." He pointed to the sword with his chin. She raised an eyebrow and looked back at Skiff. He shrugged.
"I don't think we have much choice," he said quietly. "Your friend speaks wisely," the Hawk Brother put in. "It may be your escort was attracted by you, or by the weapon you carry. It is magic, and such things are drawn by magic. I think that you would be safer in the company of two mages."
"Two mages!" boomed out a new voice. Elspeth's heart leapt right out of her body, and only Gwena's shoulder behind her kept her on her feet as her knees dissolved from a combination of startlement and fear.
"Two mages?" repeated the smaller of the griffins. "Dark wind, do my ears deceive me?"
"It talks," Elspeth thought faintly. The Hawk Brother, Darkwind, if the griffin had called him by his correct name, shrugged again.
"This is neither the time nor place to speak of my decisions," he replied, and turned to the heralds.
I phrased myself poorly. I think that you have no real choice. I think you must accept my hospitality, for your own safety and the safekeeping of that which you carry. Though what the council will say of this, he added, looking at the griffin who had spoken, and shaking his head ruefully, I do not care to contemplate. The arrogance was back, an imperious quality more suited to a prince of some exotic realm than this, whatever he was. She wanted to angrily deny the fact that they needed protection of any kind, much less his. But much as she hated to admit it, she didn't want to have to face any more bizarre monsters. Not right away, anyway. I think we'd better go along with him, Elspeth, Skiff Mine spoke tentatively, as if he expected her to turn on him and lash him with her anger for such a suggestion. I don't know about you, but we can't face any more without some rest, and I really would like to know a little more about what's going on around here before we go charging off on our own. He's some kind of border guard, she thought, though not without some resentment. It is his land. I could do with a little less of an attitude, though. She would have preferred to tell him exactly what he could do with his so-called protection, to tell him that she would be perfectly fine, to inform him in no uncertain terms that whatever he thought, she had been sent here, to this very place, by those Shinnein brethren of his, and that she intended to wait here for them. On the other hand, she had no idea why the Shinnein had sent her here, nor if they themselves intended to meet her. Maybe all they had meant was to put her in the hands of these Hawk brothers. What do you think? She asked Duena. That he is right. We have no choice, came the companion's prompt reply. It is not necessarily a bad thing. You were in search of mages. He is a mage. So is the griffin. And according to the chronicles, many of the Hawk brothers are mages. They taught Vanyl, did they not, when the herald mages could not? Let's see if someone's willing to come with us, or teach me first, she replied sourly. So it was fairly well unanimous. He's right, she told Skiff shortly, in their tongue, much to the older herald's relief. And so are you. We're all tired, and as long as this isn't an imprisonment... I don't think it is, Skiff replied. I think he'd let us go if we really wanted to. I've got the feeling that we're kind of an annoyance to him, not something he'd keep around if he had the choice. That didn't make her feel any better. All right, she told the Hawk brother, trying to conceal her annoyance. Where is it you want us to go? Instead of replying, he gestured curtly for them to follow. She seethed a little at the implied discourtesy. As the griffins lofted themselves into the air, she stood aside for Skiff and Simri to get by her. She did not want to follow him too closely just now. She was afraid she would lose what was left of her temper. She had gotten used to being the one making the decisions. Now she was again following someone else's orders. That galled her as much as this Darkwind fellow's arrogance. In fact, she decided somewhat guiltily as she led Gwena in Simri's wake, it probably galled her more. Chapter 22 Darkwind led the way for this strange parade of outlanders, winding through the piles of stone on the weed-grown path that led from this end of the ruins to the griffin's lair. It was a good thing that they had enlarged it. Between two outlanders, their spirit horses, and Nyara, it would have been crowded otherwise. He wished strongly for something to ease his aching head, or to make him able to forget everything that had happened for the past several days. Or both. Well, perhaps not everything. I have my father back again. That was no small gain, even when weighed against all the grief and pain. He concentrated on staying on his feet, glad beyond telling that this incursion would likely mean there would be nothing more today. If only he were in his Ekale. He had begun this day, wearied and emptied of all strength, or so he thought. He had not found anyone able to take his patrol for him, so he had taken to the border, resigned to another stretch without rest. It had been 2 days without sleep now. But it had been quiet, amazingly so, until, When, of course, he was at the very opposite end of his patrol, he sensed magic, powerful magic, being used somewhere near the Griffin's lair. He thought it might have been Treyvan doing something to free the Grifflets from Falcon's Bane's control. But any hope he'd had of that had been shattered by Treyvan's mind call. There was a massing of Mistborn beasts, Falcon's Bane's creatures, in pursuit of two humans, and one of those humans was using magic to try and drive them off. Without success, as it happened, the Griffins were going to their aid. It was his territory, so must he. He and they had arrived on the spot simultaneously to play rescuer to Outlanders. That had irritated him beyond reason. He was tired, and he saw no reason to save ignorant fools from the consequences of their own folly. He had intended to send them back where they came from, whether they were still in danger or not, until he actually saw who, or rather, what, he had rescued. He glanced back over his shoulder at them, trying not to look as if he was doing so. Unsettled was the mildest term for the way he felt right now. Shaken probably came closer. Profoundly shaken. Well, it is not every day that a pair of guardian spirits and a pre-mage war artifact fold wings on your doorstep. And when one added the fact that the person bearing the artifact, and in charge of the more potent of the guardian spirits, was a completely untutored mage of adept potential. If this is a trial of my abilities, the gods have no sense of proportion. He was exhausted, bewildered, and one step short of collapsing. All he could think of was to take these outlanders to the Griffin's lair, where they had left Nyara. Treyvan agreed, and concurred with his judgment that they did not dare let these two, four, five, wander about with things as unsettled as they were. If Falconsbane got his hands on them, as he was so obviously trying to do, Darkwind was not willing to think about what uses he might make of them. With any luck, the elders were so concerned with Starblade that they would not find out about these visitors until they were long gone. And, meanwhile, perhaps he could find somewhere safe to send them. To the Shinnain? No, they had forsworn magic. Could these two have stolen that sword from the soil of the plains? That horrifying thought nearly stopped him in his tracks, until he remembered that the blade did not have the air of disuse about it that something of that nature would, and that it did have the air of something that was alien to the kind of magics that lay buried in the plains. Woman's magic, that was it. No, this was nothing that had been created by the thoroughly masculine Mage of Silence, and it did not have the look or feel of anything forged by the Shinnain. Weapons made for the servants of the Star-Eyed were as sexless as the Kalenadral. This artifact was as female in its way as Nyara. He staggered a little as he neared the lair, recovered himself before the outlanders noticed. Above all, he had to present a strong front to them. There was no telling what kind of unwitting havoc they could cause if they thought he was less than vigilant, ineffectual. He was certain now that they meant no harm, not with guardian spirits hanging about them, but they could cause a great deal of trouble if they chose to meddle without knowing what they were about. I could wish they were Shinnain. Then we would have two more useful allies at this moment. Hydona was already in the lair when they reached it. Treyvan waited outside. In there, he said shortly, wishing he dared shake his head to clear his eyes. If you have gear, Hydona will tell you the chamber you may use. When the young man looked from him to the spirit horse doubtfully, he added, The white ones, too. We will find them food if you do not have it. He bowed a little to the mare. Jehelava, lady, you honor Kashena with your presence. The spirit mare looked flattered and surprised. So did the young man. You do not look well, Treyvan noted. I do not feel well, but I shall survive, he replied. He gave Bree a toss to send him to a perch above the lair doorway, and stood, leaning, he hoped, casually, against the doorpost. The young man entered with his spirit horse. The young woman's spirit horse started to follow, and he averted his eyes with discomfort. Then he found himself sliding dizzily toward the ground, clinging not so casually to the rock as his knees buckled. Quickly, the young woman knelt beside him and unsheathed her sword.
"Peace, brother. She means no harm," Treyvan said calmly.
Darkwind wasn't so sure. He tried to get up a hand to fend her off, but instead, she put the hilt of the thing in his hand. And he heard a strange, gravelly voice in his mind.
"She says if I don't heal you, she's going to drop me down the nearest well,"
the sword told him, annoyance warring with amusement in the overtones of its, her, mind voice.
"I think she must have been taking lessons in rudeness from her predecessor, and knowing her highness, she probably would."
He nearly dropped the thing in shock, and only long training, never, never, never drop a blade, kept his numb fingers clutched to the hilt.
"Huh? Nothing too bad. Overwork, under rest, and..."
He felt the thing probing him in his memory, then suddenly pulling back.
"Oh, youngling," the sword said, dropping all cynicism. "You've had more heartbreak than anyone should ever face in a lifetime, and that much I can't heal. But I'll do my best for you. Open your shields to me."
She sounded so much like one of his teachers, an old, old adept who had ordered him about as if she had been his mother, that he obeyed without thinking twice. She took instant action. In the next moment, a gentle warmth stole over him, making him relax still further. He closed his eyes gratefully and let it in. Healers had worked on him before, but that had been for a major injury, not for general exhaustion. First came the warmth and relaxation, then came new energy, new strength. It rose in him like a tide, rather than a flood, a rising tide of warmth and golden green light that touched him within and without, folding him in great wings of brilliance, sheltering him as he had not been protected since he was a child. But the blade not only filled him with renewed physical energy, she also reopened his long unused mage channels, replenishing him with magical power as well. He was vaguely offended at first, but then practicality took hold. He had said he was a mage. Any reasons for renouncing powers were gone. There was, in fact, every reason why he should take up magecraft again.
"Thank you," he told the blade.
"Thank the girl," Need responded. "Oh, I was an adept, but never with the ability she has. She and her teacher were the first in I don't know how long that fought me and won. And all this power, it's coming through her. So save your thanks for her." "I'll be done soon."
The blade was as good as its word. The dizziness and weakness were gone, and shortly after that, he felt as refreshed as if he had never endured the stresses of the past 5 days. He stood up and gingerly passed the sword back to its bearer.
"That was kindly done," he said,
with all the courtesy he could muster, embarrassed by the awareness that his dealings with her had been woefully short of courtesy up until this moment.
"Thanks is not adequate, but it is all I can offer."
She seemed first surprised, then pleased, then blushed, averting her eyes. "That's all right," she said. "I mean, you looked like you needed help. She doesn't like men much, but I figured I could convince her to do something for you." He looked to the young lady and spirit mare, nodding gravely.
"There have been troubles here," he told her. "There still are troubles, evil ones, and you have tumbled unwitting into the midst of them. My time is short, my powers are strained, and my patience, alas, never was particularly good. Please, even if I offend you, never hesitate to follow my orders or Treyvan's. It may well mean not only your life, but ours."
She looked back up at him, resentment warring with respect in her eyes.
"Respect one."
"I will," she said, a little grudgingly, and he sensed that she was not often minded to follow anyone's orders, much less a stranger's. "You're right, I suppose. We're not from around here. We can't possibly know what's going on." "Imperious," he noted thoughtfully. "Used to giving the orders, not taking them." The sword called her Highness. that may well be truth, rather than sarcasm. "I am Darquin Kashena," he told her. "This ruin is nominally part of Kashena territory. Treyven and Hydona are the actual guardians here. There are few who would care to dispute boundaries with them." He meant that as a subtle warning, but she cocked her head to one side, looking from him to Treyven and back again, and said accusingly, "There is something very wrong here. You said we've walked into a situation we don't understand, but everything, absolutely everything I've seen tells me that it's worse than that. You people are in trouble." He narrowed his eyes speculatively. "Why do you say this?" he asked before he thought. "Well, I'm thinking of you, for one thing," she said. "Need says you were exhausted, that you'd gone days without rest. You don't do that unless you're in some kind of trouble. Everything around here seems... well, it feels like being on the edge of a battlefield, on the eve of a war. And if that's what we've walked into, I'd like to know." She gulped. "I think, on the whole, I'd just as soon take my chances with those things you chased off. I'd rather not get caught in another all-out war, especially not a war involving magic." Again, he spoke before he thought, with a little more scorn than he had intended to show. "And what do you know of warfare?" She scowled. "I've fought in a few battles," she snapped. "Have you? And you still haven't answered my question." "Why should I?" he retorted. He raised his head proudly, planting his fists on his hips. "I know nothing of you, other than that you came across the plains, and that you likely did without the knowledge of the Shinnein." "What? You want my credentials?" she scoffed, now obviously very angry, but keeping a firm grip on herself. She turned quickly to her saddlebag and turned round again with a roll of vellum and something else. "All right, I'll give you what you'll recognize. My teacher's teacher was Tarma Shayna Telesedrin. My teacher is Captain Carowin of the Skybolts, cousin to most of the Telesedrin. She no longer rides a war steed, but when she did, it was always called Hellsbane. I came to Katashina Inn looking for Telesedrin. One found me. A Kalenadral. He, she, or it gave me these." She thrust the roll and an enameled copper disc at him. The latter, he recognized. It was one of the clan tokens customarily used to identify clansfolk passing through Taladrass lands. And it was indeed a genuine Telesedrin token. He even recognized the maker's glyph on the back. That they had given this outlander one meant that they expected her to be passing through both the plains and Taladrass territory, and had granted her as much safe passage as they could. But the other thing, the roll of vellum, proved to be as great a shock as the spirit horse. It was a map of the plains. Darquin had heard of such things, but the normally secretive Shinnein had never before let one out of their hands, to his knowledge, not even to their cousin, Captain Carowin. And it was a genuine map, not a fake. It showed every well and spring in the plains, used the correct reckonings, and showed the correct landmarks, at least as far as he could verify. For that much, it was priceless. It showed more than that. It showed, if you knew what to look for, the locations of common campsites of the four seed clans and the offshoot clans. Anyone who had that information would know who held which territories and where to find them. And it also showed the ruins here on the rim, circled in red ink, fresher than anything else on the map. "That was where I was supposed to go. At least, that's what I guessed," she said assertively, stabbing her finger at the red mark. "I don't know what it was I was intended to find, but it certainly looks to me as if I was to come here. If you know better, I'd be pleased to hear where I'm supposed to be." "No," he replied vaguely, still staring at the solid evidence of Shinnein cooperation in his hands. "No, I would say that you are correct." This incident was rapidly turning into something he was not ready to deal with. It had looked like a simple case of outlanders wandering where they didn't belong. Then it became a case of keeping these people out of Falkensbane's hands. But now it looked as if the Shinnein had sent these outlanders here. And what that could mean, he did not know. "Please," he said, rolling up the map and handing it back to her. "Please, if you would only rejoin your friend, the young man. I need to speak with Treyven." She set her chin stubbornly, but he could be just as stubborn. He crossed his arms over his chest and stood between her and the pathway out, silent and unmoving, except for his hair blowing in the breeze. Finally, she stuffed the map back in her belt with an audible sniff and turned to enter the lair. She went inside, but the white spirit horse did not. The mare stared at Darkwind for so long, he began to feel very uncomfortable. It was very much as if she was measuring him against some arcane standard, only she knew. In fact, she probably was, given the little he knew about manifesting spirits. Starblade had once seen Alessia A. Kalenadral, but he never had, and he had been perfectly content to have it remain that way. Evidently, the gods had other ideas. "A word with you," the spirit mare said. Then she looked up at Treyvan and included him in the conversation. "Both of you," she amended. Treyvan looked down at the little mare from his resting place atop the lair and rumbled deep in his throat. "We have many problems and little leisure, my lady," he replied in mind speech. "I do not mean to belittle your troubles, but we have no time for yours." She tossed her head and stamped one hoof with an imperiousness that matched her rider's. "That is exactly what I wish to speak with you about, your troubles. You are being very foolish to dismiss us so lightly. I tell you, you need us, and I swear to you that you may trust us." With every word, she glowed a little brighter to his mage sight, until he finally had to shield against her. "Lady, I know you think I can trust you," he replied stubbornly, "but you and she are not of my people. Your ways are not ours, and what you think important may mean nothing to us. And please to dim yourself," Treyvan added. "You do not need to set the forest afire to prove what you are." Her glow faded, and she pondered for a moment. "It is true that we are not of the same peoples, but I will tell you what brings us here. The child needs tutoring in magecraft. That is the most important of our tasks. Other than that, we have no agenda to pursue, and we are four more to stand at your side in your troubles." She snorted delicately. "We have departed from the road that had been planned for her. At this point, I do not see how further deviation from that plan can matter." The road that had been planned for her? Interesting words, and ones that explained a great deal about the girl's temperament. I doubt I would much care for being blown about by the winds of fate. In fact, I just might become as belligerent as she has. He began to feel a bit more in sympathy with the girl, and quite a bit more inclined to trust her. "Lady, we may not agree on what is to be done here," he warned. "This is Taladrath land. We follow the task given to us by our lady, and nothing is permitted to interfere with that." She shook her mane impatiently. "Does it matter in whose name good is done? Evil done in the name of a power of good is still evil, and good done in the name of a power of evil is still good. It is the actions which matter, not the name it is done for. You stand against evil here. We will help, if you will have us. And then, perhaps, you may help us." Well, that seemed reasonable enough. He raised an eyebrow at Treyvan. The griffin, adroit at reading human faces, cocked his head to one side. "She seems sincere. She is something that cannot speak falsely. And, Darkwind, we and Kashena are not strong enough that we can afford to neglect any form of aid, especially if we are to free Dawnfire and my children." He nodded. "If that's the way you feel, then I agree." He turned to the mayor. "Lady, we accept your offer with thanks." The spirit nodded emphatically. "Good. Shall we confer on what needs to be done?" "Things to be done. The rescue of Dawnfire, for one thing. After Starblade's revelations, he was certain that she was in Falcon's Bane's hands. He could not leave her there. He told himself it was for Kashena's sake, that the clan could not afford another like Starblade, but it was as much for his sake as the clan's. Over and over, the thought had plagued him, intruding into everything, that if he had only been more vigilant, If he had only taken the time to explain why he had wanted her to stay clear of the Griffins that day, none of this would have happened to her. He knew now that he was not to blame for the shattering of the Heartstone. But this he was guilty of. He had allowed Falconsbane to lure him into relaxing his guard. And this was the result. "Bring your people out," he told the spirit, "as soon as they are ready to talk. And I will see if I can explain this before night falls. And explain," he added grimly, "just what it is that we mean to do." To his surprise, although he should not have been surprised, the outlanders had a very good grasp of the situation once he sketched it. As the young man said, "It's not much different from our position at home, except that the scale is a lot smaller." The girl sat with her chin resting on both her hands as she listened, then offered a question. "Why is it that this Falconsbane hasn't made a frontal assault on Kishena? He has to know that you're in trouble, and this would be the perfect time to take you." This Elspeth seemed much easier and more relaxed, now that her blade was out of its sheath and away from her. The spirit penned within the sword, Need was its name, had stated that there was very little it could contribute. It had never been a tactician or a leader, and did not care to begin learning the craft now. Furthermore, there was a great deal she could do to shield the Grifflets from further tampering, so that was what she had been left to do. Elspeth had been a leader and a tactician, at least in small skirmishes, and she had studied her craft under one of the legendary mercenary captains of the modern times. Word of the Shinnain cousin had penetrated even into Taladras lands, via the few bards that had congress with Taladras and Shinnain, and her pupil's question had merit.
"I do not know," he replied frankly.
"I am fairly certain that he has the power to pursue a frontal assault. It may be that he has not, simply because he does not think in those terms, because he prefers to weaken from within and gnaw away from without, until little by little he has wrought such damage that he can overcome his target with little effort or losses." "That only works if you don't know what he's doing," she pointed out. "Once his victim knows..."
"It may be too late," Treyvan rumbled. "I suspect his tactics have done very well in the past."
"He probably enjoys working that way," the young man, Skip, a very odd sort of name, to Darkwind's mind, put it. "I mean, it's obvious from what the Cat Lady said, that he positively revels in making people suffer. Seems to me he wouldn't get half the pleasure out of being straightforward." Elspeth bit off an exclamation.
"That's it," she exulted. "That's his weakness. That's what makes him vulnerable. He's so busy with his convoluted plans that if he sees us trying one thing, he might not expect a second attack that was perfectly straightforward. Look, Darkwind, if I were you, that's what I'd do. I'd pretend to try to negotiate with him, and while he thought he was tying me in knots, I'd make a straight assault to get Dawnfire free. I'd also try and do as much damage as I could on the way out," she added thoughtfully. "But then, I'm well known to be a vindictive bitch." She glanced sideways at Skiff as she said that, and the young man looked sour. Evidently she was using words he had thrown at her at some point, and he was not enjoying hearing them now, tossed back in his face. For his part, Darkwind was a little surprised by this interchange. He had been under the impression that these two were lovers, but evidently this was not so. He tucked the information into the back of his mind for later use in dealing with them. There were niceties needed with a pair of lovers that could be disposed of when working with a pair of friends or colleagues. Such as splitting them up, for instance, sending one on one mission and the second on another.
"It is a good notion," he told the girl, "except that we are not supposed to know that Falconsbane even exists, much less that he holds Dawnfire."
"Damn," she said with a frown, "I'd forgotten that. Well, what about that daughter of his, Nyara? Can she be useful?"
Now that was a thought.
Treyvan rose, anticipating his next words.
"I shall wake her,"
the griffin said, folding his wings to fit more easily through the door of the lair.
"We shall see if she is ready to be more friend than enemy,
as she claims.
Darkwing nodded grimly. Now was the time for Nyara to show her true allegiances. There was a great deal about her father and her father's stronghold and abilities that she could tell them, if she chose, and, just perhaps, some of his weaknesses. And if she did not choose to help them, well, she would see the veil after all, as she had often wished. From inside, as he turned her over to the adepts to be judged, he wondered what they would think of the creature that had eaten Starblade's bond bird before his eyes. No matter how extenuating the circumstances, he did not think they would be inclined to kindness. Dawnfire stood on her squeaking mouse, killed it messily, and leaned down to pick it up head first. She started swallowing it whole, trying her best not to think about what she was doing. At least I'm not like a poor stupid Aias that doesn't know which end to start on, she thought unhappily. At least I know enough to kill the things before I try to eat them. And I knew how to kill them in theory, if not in practice. In fact, she had learned a lot more than she was displaying. She blessed the many times she'd spent in full bond with Kier, and blessed Kier's memory for the way the hawk had shared every experience with her. No, she was not a bird, but she had the memories of what it had been like to be a raptor, and once she had overcome her initial despair, those memories had helped her learn the ways of her new body. They did not help her overcome her fear. Fear of Falkensbane was only part of it. There was another fear, a constant fear that never left her, waking or sleeping. She knew what would happen as she remained in Kier's body. The longer she remained, the more of herself she would lose, until there was nothing left but the hawk. The fact that she had adapted to the body so quickly was both bad as well as good. The more comfortable she felt, the easier it would be to lose herself. She tried to hold on to herself with utter desperation. She tried to remember everything about the scouts, the veil, Darkwind. And she panicked when she found herself in the midst of a memory and could not remember a face, a name, a setting. Was it just that these things had slipped her mind, or was it that her mind was slipping? There was no way to know. And what had happened to her body back in the veil? What if Falkensbane had killed that along with Kier's soul? What would she do then? The past 2 days had felt like 2 months. Time stretched out unbearably, and there was nothing to distract her from fear and brooding. When those thoughts drove her into a state of frenzy, there was only one way to break the cycle. She plotted her escape. She had been taken outside enough times on a creance to know all the places where escape might be possible. If she could get away. No, when she got away. She would not think if. She would head straight up, as high as a red-shouldered could go. From there, she would have an unparalleled view of the countryside. Her scouting experience would tell her where she was. If she didn't recognize anything, she would circle until she did see a landmark she knew. And Falkensbane shouldn't be able to touch her. Planning kept her sane. Planning and practice. When Falkensbane was not in the room, she practiced, as she had seen the fledglings practice, flapping until she lifted herself just above the perch, hopping down the length of her jesses and flying back to her perch. When she had to kill her food, she did so with a clumsiness that was feigned more and more often. She took out her anger on the hapless mice, ripping them with talons and beak after she had killed them. Though it was still all she could do to force herself to eat the mice afterwards. Falkensbane was not paying a great deal of attention to her, but she continued the charade, lurching clumsily up to the perch and taking a long time to get settled. She watched him carefully as she cleaned her talons and beak. He'd been very preoccupied today, and he had evidently forgotten, if he had ever known, just how wide a field of vision a raptor had. She could watch him easily without ever seeming to pay attention to him. He had been staring at the scrying stone, no longer relaxed and no longer so infernally pleased with himself. She had finally decided that the scrying stone wouldn't work anywhere except this room. Certainly he never took it with him, and there was nothing else here but her perch, his couch, the cabinets he kept his toys of pain and pleasure in, and the stone. For the past 2 days he had spent more and more time here, watching the stone and getting very intent about something. She overheard him muttering to himself. Evidently he had also forgotten how sharp a raptor's hearing was. There was something about heralds, though what that would have to do with anything, she had no notion. There was more about Valdemar, and a queen, Hardon, and Ankar. He seemed very preoccupied with 2 quite different sets of people. One set seemed to be traveling, and they had something he wanted. Wanted? That was like saying that she wanted her freedom. He lusted over this object, whatever it was, with an intensity she had never seen him display before. The other people were connected with this Ankar, who seemed to be the enemy of the first group of people. From the pacing and muttering that went on after he had watched this person, she gathered that he was toying with the notion of contracting with this Ankar and proposing an alliance. That was something new for him, or so she gathered. He wanted to, and yet he did not want to chance losing the slightest bit of his own power. Then, this afternoon, something had changed. The people he had been watching escaped what he had thought was a perfect trap, and they had taken the thing that he wanted with them. Hawkins Vane flew into a rage and flung the stone against the opposite wall with such force that he splintered the rock of the wall and reduced the stone to fragments, and she shrank back onto her perch, doing her best not to attract him to her by moving or making a sound. He paid no attention to her whatsoever. He roared for one of his servants to come and clean up the mess, and stood over the trembling boy, looking murderously at him as the terrified child carefully gathered the sharp shards in his shaking bare hands. Dawnfire trembled herself, expecting at any moment that he would take out his temper on the boy as he had on the stone. There would be true murder then. With a sick feeling, she watched him reach down. Slowly, clawed hands spread wide. But before he touched the boy, the door flew open, and 2 men in some kind of ornate uniform flung themselves into the room to abase themselves at his feet, babbling of failure and mercy. Falconsbane started, then grabbed the child to cover his surprise. He pulled the boy up to his feet by his hair and threw him bodily toward the door, showering the shards around him. This time the boy did not try to pick them up. He simply made good the chance to flee. The guards blanched, and immediately went back to groveling with more heartfelt sincerity than before. He listened to them a while, then cut them short with a single gesture. "Enough!" he growled, the fingers of his right hand crooked into claws, with the talons fully extended. The 2 men fell absolutely silent. "You failed to capture the artifact," he said, his voice rumbling dangerously. "You failed to corner the quarry. You failed to keep them from finding aid, and you failed to acquire the artifact when you had the opportunity. I should take your lives. I should remake you." The men whitened to the color of fresh snow. "There is nothing you can say that will redeem your complete stupidity," Falconsbane continued. "You will report to Draken for your punishment. I have not the time to waste upon you." The 2 men started to get up. A single snarl from Falconsbane sent them back to their faces. "I do have time to retrieve from your worthless bodies a modicum of the power you wasted in this effort." He stretched out his right hand and spread it over the 2 prone men. Dawnfire was not certain what exactly he did, but she saw the result clearly. The 2 men sat back on their heels suddenly, jerked erect like a pair of puppets. Their white faces were frozen in masks of pain, and their limbs trembled and jerked uncontrollably. Their mouths were open, but they uttered not so much as a single sound. What was truly horrible about the entire tableau was the expression on Falconsbane's face. He looked like a creature in the throes of sexual ecstasy. He had tossed his long flowing hair back over his shoulders, and he stared off into nothingness with his eyes half closed in pure pleasure. His fingers flexed. Every time they did, the 2 men's bodies jerked, and their faces took on new lines of agony. Falconsbane's eyes closed completely, and he lifted his face to the light in obscene bliss. Finally, he knotted his hand into a fist. The men shuddered. then collapsed. He opened his eyes, slowly, and gazed down on his victims with a slow, sated smile. "You may go," he purred. "Now." Limbs stirred feebly, heads raised, and the two men began to move. Too weak to do anything else, they crawled toward the door, slowly and painfully. And that wasn't even their punishment. That was just Falkensbane's way of reminding them that he was their master in all things. The first man reached the door and crawled out. All of Dawnfire's feathers slicked down flat to her body in fright. She couldn't have moved now if she had wanted to. "Reedon," Falkensbane said, as the second man started out the door. The guard stopped, frozen. In a macabre way, he looked funny, like someone caught pretending to be a dog. "Reedon, send Dylod to me on your way out." Falkensbane turned, ignoring the man's whispered acknowledgement, and began pacing beside his couch. In a few moments, another man entered, an older man, lean and fit, with elaborate flowing garments and dark gray hair and beard. "My lord," he said, waiting prudently out of reach. Falkensbane ignored him for a moment, his face creased with a frown of concentration. The man waited patiently. Patience was a necessity with Morna Litha Falkensbane, it seemed. Patience and extreme care. Finally, Falkensbane stopped pacing and flung himself down on the couch. "Dylon, I am going to propose an alliance to King Ankar of Hardorn." "Very good, my lord," Dylon responded, bowing deeply. "Alliances are always preferable to conflict." Falkensbane smiled, as if he found the man's opinions amusing. "I've been in contact with him for some time, as you know. With him, and some other rulers of the East. He agreed to meet with me in person, but he would not set a time." Falkensbane's smile faded. "When he would not specify a date, I insisted that he must come here, and that it was to be within 3 months of the initial agreement." "I assume that he has set a date, my lord?" Dylon asked smoothly. "Finally." Falkensbane scowled. "He told me just before that disaster Greedon was in charge of that he will be arriving in 3 days' time." "Very good, my lord. By gate, my lord?" Dylon asked, with one eyebrow raised. Falkensbane snorted with contempt. "No. The fool calls himself a mage, yet he cannot even master a gate. That, it seems, was the reason he would not set a date. He had to travel overland, if you will, and he did not wish anyone to know that he was en route." Dylon produced a superior smug smile. "Then you wish me to ready the guest quarters, my lord?" "Exactly." Falkensbane nodded. "I expect I will be able to persuade him to accept my hospitality after several weeks of primitive inns and the like." Dylon raised one eyebrow. "Do I take it he will not be coming directly here?" "Once again," Falkensbane snorted. "He prefers, he says, to remain in neutral land. I directed him to the valley I flooded with death smoke a while ago. It is secure enough. The horned vermin will not be using it again soon. And if he proves unreliable, well..." The adept shrugged, rippling his hair and mane. "I flooded it once, and can do so again." "Very good, my lord." Dylon bowed and smiled. "Better to eliminate a menace than deal with a conflict." Falkensbane chuckled, the deep rumbling laugh that Dawnfire knew only too well. She crouched a little smaller on her perch. "Ah, Dylon, your philosophy is so... unique." Dylon bowed again, smiled, but said nothing. Falkensbane waved negligently at him. "Go," he said. Then as Dylon started for the door, he changed his mind. "Wait," he called, and scooped something up from beside his couch. As Dylon turned, he tossed something at him, and as the servant caught it, Dawnfire saw it was the falconer's glove. "Take that bird with you," he yawned. "I am fatigued, And she no longer amuses me. Take her to the mews. It is time for her to learn her place in life.
Very good, my lord, Dailan repeated. When the servant approached Dawnfire, she tensed, expecting trouble. But evidently he was so unfamiliar with falconry that he did not even attempt to hood her. He merely took the ends of her jesses, clumsily, in his free hand, and stuck his gloved hand in her general direction. If he didn't know enough about falconry to hold her jesses properly, he might not know enough to hold them tightly. She hopped onto his hand as obediently as a tamed cage bird, and remained quiet and well-behaved. And as he carried her out of the room and away from Falconsbane's sight, she saw with elation that he was barely holding the tips of her jesses. Of course, she had fouled them. She couldn't have helped that. He evidently found that very distasteful, and he was avoiding as much contact with the chalked leather as possible. And he was holding the arm she rested on stiffly, far away from his body, lest, she supposed, she also drop on his fine robes. And if that particular function had been within her control, she would have considered doing just that. He could not find a servant anywhere as they passed through silent stone corridors on the way to the outside door. That elated her even further, even as it visibly annoyed him. He was going to have to take her outside himself. He dropped the jesses, leaving them loose, as he wrestled with a massive, brass-bound wooden door, trusting in her apparent docility. She rewarded that trust as he got the door open. A real hawk would have bolted the moment a scrap of sky showed, but she was not sure enough of her flying ability to try for an escape. The man was so fussy, she was hoping he would take the time to make sure the door was closed before reaching for her jesses again. "Please, Lady of Stars, please don't let him see a servant out here." He looked about him, squinting in the light, as he emerged from behind the bulky door into the flagstoned courtyard, frowning when he found the courtyard as empty as the corridors. He held her with his arm completely extended, away from his body, as he started to shove the door closed. "Yes!" She crouched and launched herself into the air, wings beating with all her might, just as she had practiced. With a cry of despair, Dailan made a grab for her dangling jesses. But it was too late. She flung herself into the freedom of the blue sky, putting every bit of her strength into each wing beat, exultation giving her an extra burst of power as Dailan dwindled beneath her, waving in wild despair. Chapter 23 Skiff sat very quietly in his corner of the Griffin's lair and made up his bedroll with meticulous care. Elspeth had complained a few days ago that she felt as if she were being written into a tale of some kind. Now he knew how she felt. Strange enough to see griffins this close, but to be rescued by them, hear them talk. No one at home is ever going to believe this. The fighting had been real enough, and he'd seen plenty of misshapen things in the ranks of Ankar's forces, too many to be surprised by the creatures that had been sent against them. But talking griffins, hawk brothers? No, they're going to think we made this up. He tried not to show his fear of the griffins, but one of his friends was an enthusiastic falconer, and he knew what a beak that size and talons that long could do. The bigger of the two griffins was already inside the roofed-over ruin when he entered it. The place was 10 times larger than his room at Haven, but it seemed terribly crowded with the griffin in it. "Excuse me, my lady," he'd said humbly, hoping his voice wouldn't break. "But where would you like me?"
"I don't know," said the griffin.
He coughed to cover his nervousness. "Excuse me?"
"My name is Sidona, youngling," the griffin said, and there was real amusement in its voice. "It means kindness. You may put your things in that chamber. The changed child will show you."
That was when he noticed a girl in the next chamber over, peering around the edge of the opening. Obediently, he had hauled his saddlebags and bedroll across the threshold, wondering what on earth a changed child was. Then the girl moved out of his way, and fully into the light from the outer door, and his eyes nearly popped out of his head.
She didn't have fur, and she didn't walk on four legs, but she had sharply feline features, slit-pupiled eyes, and the same boneless liquid grace of any pampered house cat he'd ever seen. He managed to stammer out a question about where he was to put his things. She answered by helping him. And that was when he noticed that once the initial shock of her strangeness wore off, she was very attractive. Quite pretty, really. He smoothed his bedroll and watched her out of the corner of his eye as she brought armfuls of nest material to put between it and the hard rock. She was more than pretty. She was beautiful. Especially when she smiled. "Thank you," he said, just to see her smile again. Which she did, a smile that reached and warmed those big golden eyes. There hadn't been a lot of smiles out of Elspeth lately. It was nice to see one. "Let me aid you," she said softly, and knelt beside him to help him arrange a more comfortable bed, without waiting to hear his answer. There hasn't been a lot of help out of Elspeth either lately, he thought sourly. In fact, this girl was Elspeth's utter opposite in a lot of ways. Quiet, soft-spoken, where Elspeth was more inclined to snap at the most innocent of questions. "What's your name?" he asked her, as they took the opposite ends of the bedroll and laid it over the bedding prepared for it. "Nyara," she said, and looked shyly away. That was when Elspeth came in and put her own gear away, efficiently and without a fuss, but it broke the tentative conversation between himself and Nyara, and the girl retreated to her corner. "She's so mechanical. She's like a well-oiled, perfectly running clockwork mechanism. She's just not human anymore." In fact, for all of her exotic strangeness, Nyara seemed more human than Elspeth did. He stripped off his tunic and changed his filthy, sweat-sodden shirt for a new one, with sidelong glances at Elspeth. She changed torn shirt and breeches, both cut and stained with blood, although there was no sign of a wound on her. She took no more notice of him and Nyara than if they had been stones. No heart, no feelings, no emotion, no patience with anyone who isn't perfect. As cold as... Nyara is warm. A sound at the door made him start as he laced the cuffs of his shirt. The man who had rescued them, Darkwind, stood shadowing the door. Skiff had not heard him until he had deliberately made that sound. He spoke with griffins, moved like a thought, hid in the shadows. He was far more alien than Nyara, and colder than Elspeth. He looked slowly and deliberately into Skiff's eyes, then Elspeth's, then Nyara's. "Come," he said. "It is time to talk." Why does it seem as if a whole week has passed since this morning, and a year since we first entered the plains? Elspeth asked, her dark brown eyes fixed on the horizon, as the last rays of the sun turned the western clouds to gold and red streaks against an incredibly blue sky. The young man called Skiff was contemplating Nyara, as he had been since she had been awakened. Darkwind was watching Elspeth and her friend, though mostly Elspeth, rather than the sunset. She had washed and changed into another of those blindingly white uniforms, and he found himself wondering idly how she would look in one of the elaborate robes tailor dress adepts favored. In better days, he'd had time to design clothing for his friends. Tailor dress art had to be portable because they moved so often, and clothing was as much art as it was covering. His designs had been very popular back then, not as popular as Ravenwing's feather mask, but she had been practicing her art for longer than he'd been alive. In fact, he had been proud, terribly proud, that his father had worn some of his designs. One of the things that had hurt him had been finding those outfits discarded soon after he had joined the scouts, in the pile of material available to be remade into scout camouflage. Now he knew why his father had done that, discarded the clothing where he would be certain to find it. He'd meant to drive Darkwind farther away, to save him. The knowledge turned what had been a bitter memory into something more palatable. As he contemplated Elspeth, he imagined what he would design for her. something hugging the body to the hips, perhaps showing that magnificently muscled torso. Then, with a flaring skirt, slit to properly display those long, athletic legs. Definitely in a brilliant emerald green. Or maybe something that would enable her to move and fight with complete freedom. Tight wine-red leather trews laced up the side, an intricately cut black tunic, a soft red silk shirt with an embroidered collar and sleeves. What in hell am I doing? How can I be thinking of clothing right now? Maybe it was that she cried out for proper display. White was not her color. The stark uniform only made her look severe, like a purposeful, unornamented blade. After talking with her at length, there was no doubt in his mind that she was a completely competent fighter, that this was an important part of her life. But there was more to her than that. Much more. Her outer self should mirror her complicated inner self. She needed that kind of setting, with her spare, hard-edged beauty. Unlike Nayara, who would never look anything other than lush and exotic, sleek and sensuous, no matter what she wore. Nayara sat on the opposite side of Skiff, glancing sideways at him. Skiff couldn't take his eyes off her. She had proved, once revived, not only cooperative, but grateful that all Treyvan had done was put her to sleep. Her reaction, completely genuine so far as Darkwind was able to determine, had shamed him a little for behaving with such suspicion and cold calculation toward her. On the other hand, she herself had confirmed what Darkwind and Treyvan had suspected, that she was a danger. She confessed that she could be summoned by her father at any point, and if unfettered, she would probably go to him, awake or asleep. She did not know if he could read her thoughts at a distance, but was not willing to say that he couldn't. "If you have any doubt, you must send me to sleep again, and tie me," she had said humbly. "Do not waste shields upon me that you may give to the little griffins." That last had won Treyvan. Darkwind was still not so sure, but his own misgivings were fading. She had given them an amazing amount of information about Mornalitha's stronghold. The problem was, the place was a miracle of defensive capability. Nayara bitterly attributed her easy escape now to the fact that her father had wanted her to get away. Extracting Dawnfire from that warren was looking more and more difficult. Active discussion had died before the sun sank into the west. But Elspeth was still thinking about the problem, and not simply admiring the sunset. "Darkwind? She's a bird, right? What about getting in, turning her loose, and making some other bird look like her?" Elspeth turned toward Darkwind as the last sliver of sun vanished. One person, maybe two, could get away with that.
"Now that is the kind of sortie I know how to run," the sword put in.
Darkwind looked pointedly at Nayara. She coughed politely. "This would be a good time for me to absent myself. Could I take a walk, perhaps?" she asked. "Could someone go with me?" And she glanced significantly at Skiff, who flushed but did not look as if he would turn down the invitation. Darkwind found himself torn by conflicting emotions. He knew very well what was likely to happen as soon as those two found themselves alone, and while on the one hand he was relieved that Nayara had found herself a safer outlet for her needs than himself, he also was unreasoningly jealous. He didn't trust himself with her. He didn't trust her. She had already told them that Falkensbane had ordered her to seduce and subvert him. Doing anything except exchanging pleasantries with her was the worst possible idea at the moment. That didn't stop his loins from tightening every time she looked at him, and it didn't stop him from being envious of anyone else she cast those golden eyes upon.
"I've done my share of breaking into buildings in my misspent youth," Skiff said hesitantly, with one eye on Nayara. "But I have the feeling you're thinking of using magic, and that's where you lose me."
"I suppose we could go take that walk, out of earshot. If only one person goes in, I guess it wouldn't be one of us heralds, so what I know is pretty superfluous." Darkwind glanced at Elspeth. He thought he saw a little smile playing at the corners of her mouth, but the light was fading, and he couldn't be sure. He wondered if she would be so amused if she knew what he knew about Nayara. But there didn't seem to be any reason to object. "Stay within the ruins," he said curtly. "Skiff, I hold you responsible for this woman. Remember what she's told us. She can't even trust herself." Skiff nodded, but he also rose to his feet and courteously offered Nayara his hand to help her rise as well. Nayara took it, though she didn't need it any more than Darkwind would have, and she held it a moment longer than she needed to. "I don't think he has any idea of what he's in for. She just may eat him alive." He stopped himself before he could say anything. "She isn't my property. She's too dangerous right now for me to touch. It doesn't matter what I want. Acting on what you want is something only children think is an adult prerogative." So he held his tongue and watched the two of them walk slowly into the shadows of the ruins, side by side, but carefully, not touching. The sexual tension between them was so obvious that they might just as well have been bound together by ropes. "I know I'm being incredibly obnoxious to ask this," Elspeth said behind him, "but were you two lovers?" "No, lady," he said absently as he struggled to get his jealousy under control. "No, we weren't. She has that much control of herself. Her father ordered her to seduce me, therefore she would not. Otherwise." He paused, then continued, sensing that this particular young woman would not misinterpret what he was saying, and sensing that he could somehow reveal anything to her without fear of coming under judgment. "Otherwise we might well have been. She was created for pleasure. I think you know that, or have guessed. It drives her before hunger or pain. She is probably quite adept at it. She has had most of her life to learn it, and practice." Elspeth considered his words for a moment as he turned back to face her. "You aren't angry at Skiff, I hope." He uttered a short, humorless laugh. "Angry? No. She cannot help what she is. Envious? Yes. Much as I hate to admit it, envy is not a pretty trait. And you?" Her soft laugh was genuine. "I am so relieved that he has finally found someone to, well, drag off into the ruin," Darkwind suggested delicately. "Exactly. I can't tell you how relieved I am. He has been a very good friend for many years," she said, tilting her head to one side as she sat silhouetted against the indigo sky. "And he has been under a great deal of strain lately."
"And were you lovers?"
Darkwind asked sharply, in a tone that surprised even him.
"Why should I care?" he wondered. "They're outlanders. They'll get what they need and leave, like the breath of wind on a still pond. The only impression they can make is a fleeting one."
She didn't seem to notice. "I haven't been entirely candid with you, Darkwind, though mostly it was because I didn't think rank was going to impress you any, and might have made you reject us out of hand."
"Ah, so my surmise was right."
She took a deep breath. "I'm next in line for the throne. Not that I particularly want it," she added, and there was a kind of chagrin surprise in her voice, which is odd. Because when I was little, I thought that being made heir was the highest possible pinnacle of success. But there it is. Now I have it, and I rather wish I didn't. Skiff has always been a kind of big brother to me, and there were always rumors about the two of us."
"But were they true?"
he persisted. He shifted a little, not because he was uncomfortable outside, but because he was acutely uncomfortable inside.
Jealousy again, and this time for no damned reason. "It must be overflow from Nayara," he decided. "Gods of my fathers, this is embarrassing. Have I no self-control?"
"No," she said calmly, relieving his jealousy by her answer. "No, he always thought of me as a little sister. Until we went out on this trip together.
Then he suddenly decided that he was in love with me. She sounded annoyed, to his great satisfaction. I cannot for the life of me imagine why, but that's what he decided, and I've been trying to discourage him. Maybe once I would have been happy for that, but it's not possible, Darkwind. I have duties as the heir, if I ever get back in one piece. If I were to make any kind of alliance, I have to consider my duties first, and anything permanent would be weighed against them. Love, even if genuine, could only be secondary. Mother married for what she thought was love the first time, and it was a total disaster. Skiff is so blinded by his own feelings that he won't even consider anything else.
Ah, he replied, I take it that you are far from convinced that what your friend feels is love.
She snorted. Infatuation, more like it. I've been trying to emulate my teacher, Carowin, since we left Valdemar, and he worships her. That may have been the problem.
So she feels no tie beyond friendship for this skiff, he thought, with a feeling of satisfaction. Well, if she is going to learn magic, that's just as well. She'll have a great deal to learn, coming to it this late, and she'll have no time for anything but study. That may have been the situation, he responded, sensing she was waiting for some kind of reply. But you sounded very annoyed just now with him. May I ask why? If there is friction other than what you have told me, I need to know. Nothing other than that once he became infatuated, he wanted to wrap me in silk and stick me in a jewel box, she replied, the annoyance back in her voice. I think I have him cured of that, but in case I haven't, the problem may come up again. He nodded, forgetting that it was dark enough that she couldn't see the nod, then coughed politely. Thank you, Elspeth. That could cause some problems. I hope I have not caused you distress by asking you these questions. No, not at all, she replied, surprise in her voice. You are a very easy person to confide in, Darkwind. Thank you for giving me the chance to unburden myself. My companion thinks Skiff is perfect for me, and Need thinks he's an utter loss, so any time I say anything to either of them, all I get is lectures. Companion? Oh, that must be the spirit mare. But she said it as if it were a name. Companion? He asked, as the first breath of the evening wind flowed through the stones and breathed the hair away from his face. My not-horse, she replied, and there was a smile there that he felt across the darkness between them. The one you have very graciously been treating not like a horse. We call them companions. Every herald in Valdemar has one. They choose us to be heralds. He hesitated in confusion. Could you please explain? Certainly, if you don't mind my coming closer, she replied. He peered through the darkness at her to see if she was being flirtatious, but she appeared to be swatting at her legs. There seemed to be some kind of nocturnal insects on this rock, and they liked the taste of herald. By all means, come sit beside me, he replied, grateful to the night ants. There are no night ant nests here. She rose, brushing off her legs, as he moved over on his rock to give her room. Now, he continued, about these companions of yours. Shouldn't we be discussing how to get Dawnfire free? She replied as she seated herself, her tone one of concern. It's easy to get distracted. We are discussing Dawnfire, he told her, a little grimly. You and this companion of yours may be better suited to the task than I. I need to know as much as possible about you. But Skiff won't be back for some time, he assured her, and I have but two concerns regarding him. The first, that her father not attempt to contact or call her while he is with her. And the second, she asked. He sighed and leaned back on his hands. That she leave enough left of him to be useful. She chuckled, and he felt the corners of his mouth turning up in a smile. Now, he continued, about this companion.
Nyara could have shouted her joy aloud, as Darkwind gave them tacit permission to go off alone. Skiff could have been ugly, foul-breathed, pot-bellied, bow-legged, bold and obnoxious, and she would not at this moment have cared. He was safe. That was what mattered. Mona Lisa had not ordered her to seduce him, did not even know that he existed, so far as she knew. She could ease the urges that had been driving her to distraction since her body began to heal, and do so without the guilt of knowing she would be corrupting him. Do so only to pleasure herself and him, and not with any other motive of any sort. That he was cleanly handsome, well-spoken, well-mannered, that turned the expedition from a simple need to a real desire. She wanted him in the same way she wanted Darkwind, but without the guilt. Likewise, he wanted her. She guessed, however, that he was shy, else he would have proposed dalliance when they were first alone, in the Griffin's lair. So it would be up to her. She had a cat's hearing, to be able to discern a mouse squeak in the high grass a furlong away, and a cat's eyes, so that this light of a near full moon was as useful to her as the sun at full day. So when he had just begun to turn to her, to tentatively reach for her hand, she already knew that they were well out of earshot, and that there was a little corner amidst the pile of rocks to their left that would suit his sense of modesty very well. No ears but those equal to hers would hear them, and no eyes but an owl's would spy them out. Thank the gods, not Mona Lisa, that she had learned trade tongue, and that these strangers spoke it well. Nyara, Skiff said shyly. Oh, she had been right, taking heart when she did not pull her hand away. I'm sure this sounds pretty stupid, but I've never met anyone like you. You have no changed children in your lands? She asked, stopping, turning to his voice and standing calculatedly near him. Near enough that her breast brushed his arm. He did not, oh joy, step away. No, he replied, his voice rising just a little. No change, children. No magic. Ah, she purred, and swayed closer. You know what my father made me for. Darkwind has told you. A slight increase in the heat of his body told her he blushed. Yes, he stammered. Good, she replied, and fastened her mouth on his. He only struggled for a moment, mostly out of surprise and the anticipation that this was part of a ruse, that she meant to escape. Since that was the last thing on her mind, she told him so, with every fiber of her body. End of side 10.